This month marks the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a tense 13-day period in 1962 during which the U.S., Russia, and Cuba balanced on the verge of war. Back to 1962, an American spy plane had discovered Soviet ballistic missile sites in Cuba with the ability to launch nuclear warheads that could hit the U.S. mainland without much warning. After more than a week of negotiations, U.S. President John F. Kennedy and Russian Premier Khrushchev agreed to a deal in which Russia promised to remove the missiles from Cuba and the U.S. guaranteed it would not invade the island. Peter Golden is a journalist, novelist, and Cold War historian. Golden's O Powerful Western Star, A History of the Cold War, is now out, as is his novel Comeback Love, which takes place in this time period. And it's always a great pleasure to welcome Peter Golden to our microphones. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
And thanks for having me.
What is it, when we look at 50 years of history, of what has happened between then, is it very clear what we learned from this time, or is it still very hard to pinpoint exactly what we learned and what we didn't?
Well, it's hard. It's become a little easier. Part of the problem was that the early historians of the Cuban Missile Crisis were people involved in the Kennedy administration, and they didn't tell the truth about what happened. We also didn't know nearly as much as we thought we did. For instance, one of the great things we didn't know is we estimated there were between 6 and maybe 10,000 Soviet advisors, quote-unquote advisors, on the island. It turned out there were 40,000, 10,000 of whom were highly trained combat troops. In addition, they had warheads on the island that we didn't know about. And finally, Khrushchev did not control the technicians on the island. And that was one of Kennedy's famous quotes during the crisis, was that there's always some SOB who doesn't get the message. That has to do with when they shot down the U-2 flight on October 27th, at which point the generals and Kennedy himself was on the verge of responding by going after the missile sites. And he held off, fortunately. But Khrushchev didn't give that order.
When you look at what we know, what we knew then and what we know now, of what we knew then, as I mentioned in the introduction, of this being such a tense time, a tense 2 weeks as we figured this all out. And so the message 50 years ago, today was the day that the president actually spoke to the nation and
right.
told us what was going on. How influential was that on the American people at the time, and how much of that was truly accurate?
Well, I remember being terrified, and I've talked to a number of my peers. We were terrified because our parents were terrified. I think the biggest fact that I've taken away from my study of the crisis is that Khrushchev drastically underestimated who Kennedy was, and he sold himself his own bill of goods. There's a statement, a poker player can sell himself anything in his own hand. Khrushchev really thought that Kennedy wouldn't do anything about the missiles, which was an impression he took away from his dealings with Kennedy, and he was wrong. And as soon as he realized he was wrong, he started to order them back. But now he was in a position, how did he get out of this crisis without humiliating himself and his country? And much of the crisis is really Khrushchev figuring out how to do that and Kennedy giving him the room to do it.
And that room to do it, why? That seems to be the hard part, right?
That was the hard part, because up until they shot down the U-2, but Curtis LeMay, who was the head of the Air Force at the time, wanted to go after them. And his position, and I think he was accurate, was that the existence of the missiles in Cuba made nuclear war more probable, not less probable. The Europeans had absolutely no patience for that view, being that they faced Russian missiles all the time. However, this really came down to, would the United States ultimately enforce, it's really the Monroe Doctrine, and hold Khrushchev to a fast line, a red line. And the fact is that Kennedy communicated that to the American people, which of course scared them. But more important, he communicated that to Khrushchev, that there was a bottom line here and that something would happen if he didn't remove the missiles. Something terrible would happen.
Where are we now when it comes to bottom lines? We started off the discussion by talking about what did we learn from this. And it seems like we're still, in many cases, still doing this, well, here's the bottom line, this is here's your deadline.
Well, I think what, in retrospect, what makes the Cuban Missile Crisis, what makes it look like it was probable to be solved was that Khrushchev had experienced the Second World War. Khrushchev had actually been at Stalingrad. And so when he talked about wholesale destruction, Khrushchev knew exactly what it looked like. If you could imagine ground zero after the planes hit, right after the planes hit, that's much of what the Soviet Union looked like after the Nazis got done with it. Kennedy, of course, had lost his brother in the Second World War, his brother-in-law. And so both of them were very hesitant to sort of jump into the abyss. What you wonder about now, and particularly watching Iran and Israel, you wonder if the Iranians understand that there's a bottom line. And I think Netanyahu, one of the reasons he was pressing for a red line was he thinks that helps. And I believe it does. Whether that should be done in public, I think, is another question. But I don't think we've learned much from it. And certainly the Iranians, after all, it's Western history. That history belongs to the West, not to the Iranians. And it seems to me that they would do well to look at that, because the discussion so far about how hard the cement is and all the rest of this nonsense seems to me to be irrelevant. I think there is a bottom line that if they do create this capability, the Israelis are going to go after them, and it's not going to just be going after their sites, but going after their country. It's going to be hard. So has the world learned something? I think absolutely not. We rarely do, though, it seems. You know, that was Santayana's observation that if you don't learn from history, you're condemned to repeat it. And I don't know that we've done very well, particularly on this issue.
Because when it comes to nuclear arms, I mean, this is what we've been going through of oh, they've got them, they have this ingredient, they have that ingredient. And yet it's okay for some, it's not for others, and who polices that? And these are huge questions.
They are. And in fact, one of the things that would give me pause were I on the Iranian side here. And part of the problem, of course, is it's a dictatorship. So you can imagine how hesitant those would be to voice objections to what they're doing. Is one of the first things that Henry Kissinger did after Nixon appointed him as national security advisor was a study on who would be most likely to use nuclear weapons. And Kissinger came back with they would be if the Israelis were existentially threatened, which, by the way, if you hear all the time that term, they would be the most likely to use nuclear weapons. So I think there's a Cuban Missile Crisis sort of in slow motion, with Iran sort of in the position of being both Cuba and the Soviet Union, and Israel sort of in our position. And it's very, very dangerous. It seems to me that it would benefit all sides to take a good look at the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Let's look at our position when it comes to what is going on between Iran and Israel. Obviously, it's an election year, so there's a lot of talk as well. But where do we place ourselves in this, obviously being a huge part of the equation?
Well, I think one of the things you have to admit, being an observer here, is that we don't really know all that's going on.
Right.
For instance, recently the power was cut to one of the reactors, and it was done on the ground by troops. Now, of course, it didn't really have much of an impact because the Russians built these things, and of course they know that you're supposed to have backup power supplies for them. However, my guess is that was a warning to Iran that we have soldiers on the ground, or that we or Israel or the British, whomever is involved in this, and that we'll be willing to do things you haven't thought of yet. I personally believe the Iranians would welcome an attack on their sites because it would keep this current regime in power for another 10 years, which is why the United States, understandably, is so hesitant to do that. They think that there's a better chance of getting rid of these guys if the country can sort of collapse from the weight of its own ineptitude. On the other hand, to attack the sites would set off a wave of nationalism And so you'd have these guys around for a lot longer. I don't really have an answer, but I do know it's, you hear a lot of speculating about it on talk shows and the rest and people talking about it. I think you have to admit that we don't really have a clear idea of what we are actually doing to undermine this program, but I am sure we are doing a number of things. Whether they'll work or not, I don't know. But I don't think we're just watching.
Let's go back to 1962. How close do you believe we were?
Oh, I think you have to understand that Castro, who it seems like was bordering on the delusional, he was handing out machetes to his people to repel this invasion, had no idea of what was going to happen. Had he managed to convince a technician to do something else, fire a missile at the mainland, then we would have had then what would have followed very quickly is Cuba would have been reduced to a glowing green dot in the Caribbean, but that would have been the least of the problem. Certainly they would have fired some missiles at our cities. They probably, the Soviets would have gone toward Berlin, which would have set out an all-out nuclear war. Now, this is where Eisenhower's genius probably helped contribute to preventing the crisis. Eisenhower had a policy of, it was called mutually assured destruction. It's really not his. It goes back to the 19th century when people started to speculate the only way to stop war would be to make it so horrible no one would engage in it. And Eisenhower's position was, if you mess around with these weapons, there's no such thing as a limited response. We're going to destroy all your cities. Now, we had probably triple the number of missiles that the Soviets had, which Khrushchev knew. Mm-hmm. And so to get involved in this kind of exchange with us, we would have just decimated the Soviet cities. But we would have lost millions of people had they fired those missiles at us. When once the missiles started flying, they certainly would have started shooting at us from Cuba. And I probably wouldn't be here. I grew up in New Jersey. So,
how are we able to, you look at how protracted things are and the fact that we had these 13 days that we were able to come to a conclusion.
Well, actually it lasts, the 13 days is that's sort of Bobby Kennedy's timetable. It actually lasts longer. It lasts for another month, at which time Khrushchev and the Soviets spend a lot of time trying to placate Castro, who, don't forget, the missiles didn't just disappear when they agreed. Those missiles were still on the island, and Castro was still able to pressure some of these technicians. So the Soviets were quite worried about what was ultimately going to happen. I really think there was a lot of luck involved, Joe. I think that historians tend to be very concrete and X did this and Y did that, and to look at it as some mathematical problem. But I think that somehow we were remarkably lucky that Khrushchev came to his senses and took those missiles out, that he stood up to the people in the Kremlin, and that Kennedy put off his generals long enough for Khrushchev to do that.
Peter Golden is a journalist, novelist, and Cold War historian. His new book, Oh, Powerful Western Star, is a history of the Cold War. It's now out, as is his novel, Comeback Love. Peter Golden, always great to have you here. Best of luck. Thank you for joining us on this 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Joe.
Thank you.